Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, by EveryCycle.com, the coolest new technology around, by RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Check out any of our interviews on iTunes or Babbittville.com. And, of course, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Our next guest, when you're talking about anything having to do with triathlon, especially when it relates to Canada, Mr. Steve Fleck is our go-to guy. Steve, how the heck are you?
I am good, Bob. Thanks for having me on. And before we get too into this, I do want to sort of thank you from afar. You've been a bit of a mentor of mine on the sort of media publishing side and the race and eventing and announcing and emceeing side. So it's an honor and a privilege to and a pleasure to be on with you today.
Well, thanks, Steve. I appreciate that. So take me back. Growing up, you grew up in the Toronto area?
That's correct. Toronto was home, and got into running in that sort of first wave of running, the sort of post sort of Frank Shorter
yep.
marathon surge in the mid-1970s. I got heavily into it in high school, and well, it was moderately successful. You know, by the end of my high school career, I think I came close to, or first year of university, you know, came close to breaking, you know, 15 minutes for 5K
wow.
a couple of times. That was sort of the peak of it for me. And then triathlon. Funnily enough, 1981, first real triathlon that I think on record here in Southern Ontario, 1981, took part in that. And of course, as you know, back then it wasn't like it is now. There's not a race every weekend. It was like one triathlon a year.
Exactly.
So, and you didn't really call yourself a triathlete, you know, just doing one race a year. But it sort of piqued my interest, and as the races, you know, ramped up and there was more and more of them here and elsewhere, I started to get more into it and call myself a triathlete. I'm proud to be part of that first real wave in Ontario and Canada, you know, through the 1980s and to the early to mid-1990s.
And if you think about it, when you talk about the great triathletes early on, you had the Punto sisters, Sylvia and Patricia, Ironman champions, and you look back, and Canada was always, Canadians were always successful in triathlon from the very beginning.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The Punto twins were, I mean, of course, media and communications was much different back in those days, but we were fully aware of them, and they were like within the sort of the small cadre and community that was the triathlon community back then. They were very well known and very inspirational, definitely.
And so as the Canadians were becoming a bigger part, a bigger player, especially at the major event was Ironman Hawaii, which was a world championship, even though there weren't a heck of a lot of other Ironmans around, that was the granddaddy. And early on, with the success of the Punto sisters, and followed up, with Peter Reed and Heather Fuhr and Lori Bowden, how important were those athletes in terms of the growth of the sport in Canada?
Very much so. You know, again, you know, Peter and Lori, Heather Fuhr, Lisa Bentley, you know,
yep.
as well, Melissa Spooner, you know, another woman that did very well at the Ironman. That was really it. And those athletes sprung out of shorter racing, homegrown shorter racing that had been set up here. And really the sort of the catalyst for that and the gentleman that got all that going was Graham Fraser. And Graham up his first triathlon race and series starting in 1986 in Ontario, in Grimsby, Ontario, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
It's directly across the lake. If you're looking for some geography, it's almost directly across the lake south from Toronto. It's a small town called Grimsby, and that was sort of ground zero for Graham's races that he started up. And all of those people you mentioned all sort of started out and got their sort of first start in triathlon in one of Graham's races in the late 1980s here. And we've been very lucky and fortunate here in Ontario. We've had probably one of the biggest, deepest, most mature and sophisticated triathlon markets in all of North America, you know, simply because of that and what Graham had did. And as you know, very few people swim, bike, and run for the heck of it. Triathletes need races and events to go to. So, you know, Graham set up those races. We had those races, and it was fun times. Fun times, Bob.
Were you primarily racing then and working in a different industry, or did you realize early on that, man, this triathlon thing is pretty cool? I'd like to be involved with this, not just as somebody participating, but professionally.
It was a bit of both. You know, I was racing at a reasonably high, you know, high level. I got my sort of Ironman time down to, you know, close to 9 hours. I came close to breaking nine a few times. So that's, you know, that's not really
that's
fully
a real
pro,
deal, baby.
But you're kind of scratching the surface there. But I thought I'd taken it. I felt I'd taken it, you know, about as far as I could, and I started to, one of my first real jobs was advertising sales and in media and sports media. So that's how I kind of, you know, fell into the sort of the professional and business side of it. And I've always touched, you know, being involved in endurance sports, not just triathlon, but, you know, the greater world of endurance sports, in some capacity since then. And I was around about the same time, like late 1980s, early 1990s, you know, on right on through up until today. You know, even today, that's more or less what I do.
One of the things with Graham was, obviously, he was putting on the shorter distance races, and he came in and took over the Ironman Canada. And basically, that race was on life support, I think, when Graham came in.
Yep.
And revived it. And then, you know, part of his deal, I think, was, hey, I'll take over Ironman Canada and I'll bring it back to life. But if you guys do any other Ironman events, I want first right of refusal on putting those on. And so Graham was the point person for Lake Placid and for Panama City and for Coeur d'Alene and really, really took the Ironman to another level by, think about it, there was one event in the States. If you consider Hawaii the States, it was nothing in the States until Graham brought Lake Placid and then Florida and then Coeur d'Alene and Wisconsin into the realm.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, few people know this, and this is old history now, but I think it was 1991, Ironman Canada almost didn't even happen. Like on the Thursday of the race, like everyone was there, and the race was basically not going to happen. It was so bankrupt and bereft of money and organization. And I think the next year it kind of went on, and I think it was round about then that Graham and some investors, the Bregman brothers from Toronto, got wind of this, and they decided to buy it, and the rest, as you would say, is more or less history. And the catalytic event, I think two catalytic events happened around 1999-2000 and for the triathlon business and the sport in North America around about the same time, and that was Graham launching those various other Ironman races around North America, and then Simon Whitfield winning the gold medal,
right,
at that famous first ever Olympic triathlon in Sydney, and really from there those were like lines of demarcation in the sand. There was the time of triathlon before that, and then after that, and after that we've been on this great sort of rise to where we are now. Although we've kind of flattened out, that's another story potentially we can get into, but. Since 2000, it just sort of really took off, as you know.
So you mentioned that the sport had flattened, and one of the things we've seen that, obviously, in the States as well, and I look at it, and there's so much in terms of endurance entertainment out there with Spartan Race and Tough Mudder and Warrior Dash and triathlon and marathons and Color Run. There's so much out there. Do you think that's a contributing factor up in Canada as well in terms of the numbers in the sport of triathlon being a little flat?
Absolutely. I think our situation in Canada is very much like what what's going on in the U.S. I know that there was a lengthy discussion about this at the Triathlon Business International Conference a couple of weeks ago about this flatness, the fact that it's not growing anymore. We've had some meetings, some sort of informal meetings up here of powers that be. There was a good meeting here in Ontario amongst, it was nice to see a sort of a collaborative and collective group of retailers, race directors, coaches, and various other people, you know, dabbling in the business, you know, get together and sort of discuss this. And it's growing, which is not terrible. I mean, the overall numbers, the collective numbers, I think are still quite good. But the fact that that 5 to 10% organic growth that we had year over year from the early 2000s is gone. And what do we have to do to get the sort of the next generation of triathletes in? I mean, if you look at purely the demographics, I think there's a big hole, and that's the 20 to 35 year old, age segment. I race announce it at probably 16 triathlons a year. So I'm, you know, across the board, I'm seeing a real range of events, and you can tell it's mostly 35 plus, you know, men and women who are taking part. There's not many of those younger 20, 30-somethings that are taking part. And I think the conclusion we've come at some of the meetings I've been at and some of the discussions I've had is one of the barriers, there's a number of barriers, but one of them is the cost.
Exactly.
The equipment cost.
Yeah.
It's getting very expensive to, you know, to gather all the gear together to do a triathlon versus, a Tough Mudder or, Spartan
race.
I mean, it's shorts,
color run,
t-shirt.
Any of that.
Yeah, it's shorts, shoes, and a t-shirt. That's all you need, and $50, and you're in, and a free beer at the end. So that's I'm guessing to the younger crowd, the 20 to 35 year old crowd, that's more attractive.
The other thing that I went to, I was at a Spartan event this summer out in by Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the thing that really struck me, and we used to do this at our Muddy Buddy series as well, was with triathlon, we're sort of stuck because you're blocking off roads. You got to start at 7 in the morning because you got to be out of there by 9:30, 10, 11, whatever it happens to be. You could start a Spartan race at the ski resort. You could have a 10 o'clock start, 11 o'clock start, noon start, whenever you want to go. So if you're a 20-something who likes to sleep in, you can come out and race whenever the heck you want to race. And I think that's a huge advantage rather than dealing with getting up at 4, getting out to the venue at 5, your wave doesn't go off till 9. Oh my God, you've spent a lot of time not doing anything.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. you remember your days back in university, I'm sure, Bob.
Yes.
Long ago for you and I now, but 9 o'clock was early in the morning back then. So you're absolutely right for those younger crowd. I've been to the Tough Mudder that they have up here north of Toronto, and there's 7,000-8,000 people at this thing, and it's multiple waves.
They're going
off in waves all day long, from sunrise till early afternoon. I don't know how they organize it, but it was an eye opener to see the 7,000 or 8,000 people there, and the way they did that, as you had indicated, Bob, that they go off in these waves literally all day long.
So speaking again, you mentioned Simon Whitfield, who's sprint finish to win the 2000 Olympics was spectacular, and then his silver in 2008 when he totally went for it with a couple hundred yards yet left and ended up getting nosed out by Jan Frodeno, but still got the silver. A couple of the greatest performances I've ever seen. How did that change things in Canada when he won the gold?
I don't think we were really ready for it, Bob.
A little early.
I mean, it was still nascent, the sport, in terms of, where we were at with, administration, sponsors, that sort of thing. And it was great. It was a huge thing. I mean, when you're a gold medal, I think it's a bit different in the U.S. because, you win a lot of gold medals in Olympic Games, whereas for us, they're few and far between. So when a Canadian athlete wins a gold medal, it's hard to imagine how big a deal this is. It's not just on the front pages of the sports section. It's on the front pages of the entire newspaper.
Right.
It's the lead story on the night news. Whitfield wins gold medal. I was a guest on CBC, the sort of the equivalent of your NBC morning show, for CBC in the morning, and they had me on asking me, like, what is the significance of this? What is the significance for Simon? What is the significance for the sport? And I think I said back then, even then, we're not really sure. It's still too new. We're not sure what it's going to do. I mean, for Simon, obviously, it was massive. You know, for him, it transformed his life in many different ways.
Yeah.
And he went on from, and I saw that in him personally. There was this injection of confidence into him in literally everything he did. From that point on, I could see it in his body language, in his language he used, you know, around other people, his actions. He realized, no, this is really big. I do really well at this, and I'm going to focus on this completely. As for the rest of the sport, I think it was catalytic. I mean, gradually the sport at the admin level caught up. Numbers, as I had said, started to go up significantly in terms of participation levels. We're starting to see a bit of the upside positive of that in terms of our U23 group of athletes. So these would have been literally kids watching, you know, they're 8 or 9 year old kids watching on TV, watching Simon win the gold medal and the silver medal back then. So they've obviously been inspired by what he's done. So many positives, but in a way, a bit of a disconnect in terms of when it happened.
For somebody who's seen and you've been had a front row seat at so many amazing events in triathlon, what was the most impressive performance you've seen?
Oh, yeah, like you, I don't know. I don't even know where to begin. Obviously, Simon's was transformative. I mean, to see a kid, and as you know, we all called him Junior. He was this kid that came out of us, really.
Sure.
You know, the early pioneers of the sport. And he said something. We were at a social event a few years ago, and he turned to me, and I was emceeing an event and doing a Q&A with him, and he turned to me and he said, "Steve, I just wanted to really sort of genuinely thank you for all you did. You're the first generation of athletes, because I probably couldn't have done what I did without you." And I was really touched by that. So to see a kid like that rise to that level of success, you know, out of the sport that sort of defined me was very emotional. Another one for me was Matt Long, the firefighter, from New York, who was nearly killed by a bus, hit by a bike, came back a few years later and did Ironman Lake Placid, and we were hanging out at like 2K to go on the run course, and Matt came by. And it was kind of touch or go whether or not he was going to make the cutoff. This is one of these, you know, truly sort of emotional moments that defines, you know, Ironman, I think, as you well know, Bob. And so all the way along, everyone started to run with Matt or sort of jog along with him.
Yeah.
And by the time we got onto that track, the final 400 meters that you run around the track at the high school in Lake Placid there, which was the old Olympic skating oval for the Olympics, there must have been 200 people running along with Matt. And Mike Riley's on the microphone and the music. And it wasn't a Leahy drive, Bob, but it was
pretty
damn
close.
It was pretty powerful stuff to be part of something like that. And realizing that, you know, winning is great, but for others, just finishing, like overcoming some massive challenge to take on the challenge that it is an Ironman is a whole other thing.
What is it about the sport of triathlon that is so transformative?
I think for the longest time it was because it was new and cool and it was different. You know what? You combine these three sports. You put swimming, cycling, and running, and we were all a bunch of oddballs. Like, we couldn't fit in. We didn't fit in with the runners. We didn't fit in with the cyclists. We didn't fit in with the swimmers. And I think that in itself was transformative. And then it became a serious sport. And now it transforms because people take it seriously. And now we have a history. Funny thing.
Exactly.
I mean that Simon's event, that Sydney triathlon, was 16 years ago. Graham Fraser's first race was 22 years ago, 25 years ago. So, you know, there is a history there now. And I think that's helpful in creating stories, because, as you know, stories are very potent and powerful in transforming how people feel about certain things.
Were you surprised? I always thought that, I mean, Simon was such a great racer. I always expected him to step up to 70.3 and become a factor there, too. But it's interesting. There's certain athletes. Hunter Kemper told me, never. You know, listen, I am a sprinter. I'm an Olympic distance guy. I will never be going longer than that. Did you get that impression from Simon early on that this is my distance, this is what I'm doing, I don't have any interest in going longer?
I think there's that aspect of it, but there's also you know, perhaps the athlete was finished and tired and done. I mean, Peter Reed was like that too, and there's many athletes who've walked away from a sport, you know, at the peak of their powers. Maybe that's the better thing to do than to sort of, you know, fade away. I've got sitting on my bedside table Scott Tinley's book about all that.
Racing the Sunset?
Racing the Sunset. And yeah. I bought it, you know, over Christmas. I haven't got to it yet, but I'm looking forward to read it. But I know I've talked to Scott about it, and I know that a lot of the book is about that and how athletes rationalize in their own mind stepping away from a sport. I mean, everyone's got their own sort of different, you know, their different story. But what I find fascinating is that same question comes up. I've done a number of, as I mentioned, I've done a number of sort of Q&A gigs with Simon at various events, and it almost always comes up. It's like the question is planted out there. And I can kind of see Simon rolling his eyes. Here it comes. Like, why didn't you, why? You know, it's almost like the person is incredulous that he didn't take this talent and go on. It's like what you have to do, right? So the person sounds kind of incredulous that Whitfield didn't go on to 70.3 or Ironman. And Simon's kind of rolling his eyes, but he came up with he came up this one time with a great answer, and it was very funny. It's typical Whitfield. He says, "You know what? I think I am going to do an Ironman. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get four of my best friends together, and I will pick an Ironman we're at. But it would be perfect if it could be Ironman Hawaii. And we go out, and we party all night long, we get really drunk, we got bad hangovers, then we draw straws in the morning as to who's going, four of us." Who's going to actually compete and who's going to do what leg? And he said, I hope I don't draw the run.
Exactly. Get the swim and get it out of the way. I had a couple guys years ago, a couple brothers, and what they would do is they'd go to a race with one bike, and whoever got whoever out of the water first got the bike and did the rest of the race, and the other guy got hosed. He's like, he got the swim, and then he got nothing. That was the ultimate in bragging rights. I love that. So when I look at Ironman Canada, an event with so much history, and a number of years ago it changed hands and became Challenge Penticton, and then Ironman moved down the street to Whistler. And to me, that was sort of a line in the sand. How powerful is the Ironman brand?
Absolutely.
And you had a ringside seat at all the stuff happening because you're obviously so connected up in that part of the world. What were your thoughts when you saw all this happening?
Well, that was you painted it out perfectly there, Bob. That's I think that was the moment, at least for me, anyways, and I think a lot of other people, that this Ironman thing, it's all about the brand. The venue, it's almost like it doesn't matter. You have to have a great venue for your event, but it's Ironman that's the most important thing here, not the town of Penticton. The town of Penticton, I don't want to get sort of into, you know, personalities here, but the town of Penticton was really, not really the bad guy in all this, but I think the inadvertent person and not really understanding what was going on. They thought everyone wants to come to Penticton, the South Okanagan. You've been there. It's beautiful, right?
Absolutely.
It's God's country. And they thought, and rightly, in their minds, that's why people were coming to Penticton for Ironman. They were coming here to this wonderful place in Canada and on the planet. But they were wrong in that. They were wrong. And literally within a couple of weeks, Ironman had filled up Ironman Canada at a destination at that point unknown. Yeah. They didn't even know that.
They didn't have a course.
They didn't even have a course. It filled up.
Wow.
And that was the telling moment, I think, in the power of the Iron Man brand.
Did you feel so then Iron Man fills up, Challenge Penticton, you know, has obviously their numbers went way, way down. What I like what Michael Brown is doing right now is I love the idea of having, I think he's doing four different events over 5 days this year. And then those same four events, the off-road triathlon, the aquathlon, the duathlon, and the long course championship with different distances, like the ITU distances, which have really never caught on. But four world championships over 10 days. It seems like they're heading in the right direction in terms of getting people back to Penticton.
I think so. I think it's good. I think what Michael's doing is great. I think there's an organic number of people that will come to Penticton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Challenge, that seems to has settled around 1,000 to 1,200 people.
Right.
Perhaps with these other added events, that will swell and grow. I think, Bob, we're going to have another transformative event this summer at the Olympic Games. We've kind of come full cycle here. And as you know, your country has three women,
right,
who, with one in particular,
yes,
who Gwen Jorgensen, I don't want to put any undue pressure on her, that could potentially be as transformative an event for triathlon in the United States and potentially for the whole of the sport as Simon's medal was back in Sydney, because I think that's going to be really, really big. I mean, the sport is kind of wanting, I think, getting into a box, and they need to see something else. And the sort of the Olympic distance racing, the draft legal racing, particularly in North America, has been kind of shoved to the side, and not too many people pay attention to it. But now it's going to be on television.
Yep.
You're going to have three very photogenic women who are potentially going to be on that podium or winning the race. It could be another transformative moment for the sport. And looping that back to what Michael Brown is offering in Penticton is more a triathlon festival. And the triathlon isn't just one thing. It's not just Ironman. It's not just this. It's not just that. Multisport, as you know, and we started out, you know, when we started out, we did everything,
exactly,
right? Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
these pole, yep, paddle and ski races, and you started up the Muddy Buddy. I mean, we did anything multisport. But today, triathlon's kind of painted itself into this box that it can only be this way, and a lot of that only this way is Ironman or that sort of distance racing. And that's not bad, but it's a much bigger, crazier, wilder world of multisport that's out there that really never gets addressed. So hopefully, what I'm saying in a roundabout way is I'm hoping that potential win this summer by an American woman triathlete at the Olympic Games really gives triathlon a shot in the arm and a new lease on life.
You know, it's going to be interesting, and you and I have seen this over the years. We see a lot of athletes who are great in between Olympics, right?
Uh-huh.
If you think about, yep, leading into the 2000 Olympics, I don't think many people would have not expected a Carol Montgomery to be on the podium, right? She qualified,
yes,
what, 5,000 meters and at the triathlon, one of the best endurance athletes around.
10,000.
I'm sorry, 10,000. I'm sorry, 10,000. Yep.
Yeah, I don't know if that has been duplicated yet.
I'm not sure. Yes.
Two different disciplines at the same Olympic Games.
Right.
I have to check. Yep.
And the bummer was obviously she crashed during the triathlon and was,
yep,
out of both. But, yep, we also saw, you know, Siri Lindley was the best in the world in 2001 and, uh-huh, didn't even go to the Olympics in 2004. And, you know, Barb Lindquist was obviously one of the favorites going into 2004, dominated, and wasn't, you know, didn't medal. Same with Sheila Tormina. So we see a lot of athletes, and you think about even heading into the 2000 games, who are we thinking about? Simon Lessing. I mean, a guy hadn't been,
yes,
beaten, you know, forever. And this guy didn't medal at all. So we see it all the time in people who are dominant in between Olympics. It's a different game when you get there, right? Someone like a Nicola Spierig who didn't do a heck of a lot this year. She's focusing on 2016. So it's going to be really fun to watch with Gwen Jorgensen and Sarah True and Katie Zafaris. And hopefully you'll get some Americans on the podium. Because I think you're right. I think it affects all of North America if one of those athletes wins a gold medal?
Well, that's the upside, and you and I, we've talked about how great the Olympic Games are, but it's only, you pointed
it's
out, a very valid point. It's one day, one race in 4 years, and for sport, any sport, look at the Super Bowl yesterday. I mean, the Broncos weren't supposed to win. That's why we play the games. We don't know who's going to win, and we don't know who's going to win the race. That's why we do them. And there's so many variables, particularly in endurance sports and endurance sports with equipment. As you know, anything can happen. So it's almost a freak that that the athletes who win and the ones that win consistently are even more amazing. So you're absolutely right. I mean, you can be fantastic for two or three years between Olympic Games, come up on Olympic Day, and you got a head cold or a flat tire or not feeling so well or your training's a little off or whatever, and you're not there. And then people forget about you.
When I look at the Canadian athletes who we saw in Kona this year, you know, between Lionel Sanders and Brett McMahon and the Wertel, Heather Wertel and Sarah Gross, you've got a lot of up and coming long distance athletes. And one of the stories, obviously, Lionel Sanders' story is amazing. I'm imagining that you probably knew him before this before he came back and became a great triathlete.
Yes. Yeah, he got his start, really, in the Multisport Canada triathlon series events. I know John Salt was on with you a few months ago, the founder and race director for Multisport Canada. And Lionel really got his start only like 3-4 years ago, coming to the Multisport Canada races. I'm the race announcer for all of those events. So we got to see the talent, the raw talent, and it is still very raw, you know, firsthand. And it was pretty impressive. It's funny, we've kind of been, since Simon Whitfield has retired, stepped away from the sport, we're into a bit of a trough in terms of our talent on the ITU side of things. The counter to that, our fortunes at long distance racing have risen dramatically.
Yes.
And you mentioned, I mean, Lionel Sanders, Jeff Simons, Brett McMahon, they all had you know, pretty good races at Hawaii last year. I think on paper, you know, people were hoping for better, but there were sort of stories behind the performances of each of them. You mentioned Heather Wertel, Angela Nath. I mean, Angela Nath,
yep.
She was out of the water with the front group, rode with the front group right to the end of the bike, and then because she had some minor sort of foot problem, said, I'm not going to run. And so, good grief. Like, and she's a strong runner. So imagine her, you know, going full bore. You know the Jeff Simons story.
Yeah.
Good grief.
Great story.
Yep. 30K with one crank, one-legged, gets off and runs the second fastest marathon on the day. So imagine if Simons can go, like, full bore on the bike. It's kind of frightening. I think all six of those athletes could be top 10, top 5 on best-case scenario days. At Ironman Hawaii.
So when you see someone like Lionel and you see what he's overcome, the drug addiction, and it sort of brings us back full circle of the importance of the sport and what the sport means to so many.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Oh no, I was just going to say he's got a great story. But even, I think even, you know, I sort of chatted with him briefly at one of our sort of awards banquets back in the fall and that I was emceeing. And I think he's growing kind of tired of the story.
Yes.
But, you know, we like stories.
Of course we do.
We'd already, stories are great. Stories themselves are transformative. But I think he wants to be taken seriously now as a, you know, a legitimate world-class athlete, which he is. And he's risen rather quickly and dramatically, you know, to the top of the sport. He's gone toe-to-toe with the greats, the current sort of greats in long-distance triathlon. I think he still has a lot of things to work out and figure out. It's still a very raw thing that you see out there on the race course on race day. It's very unrefined, you know, compared to his competitors. He's not as aerodynamic on the bike. He, you know, swims not
slow.
That great. He has this awkward kind of looks like he's a boxer, you know, kind of out there on the run. It's not pretty, but he gets the job done. And I think if he gets it all together, it could be frightening. They were even using the Training Peaks people that put on a great training course for their Training Peaks software during Ironman Race Week. They were even using Lionel as an example of a guy who wins the watts competition on the bike. Like, no guy on the bike will burn more watts than Lionel will, because he has to ride from behind.
Yeah.
He has to ride from so far behind. He has this totally un-aerodynamic, unrefined position on the bike. So he's just a watts machine. But they, as you know, they don't give out any awards for the guy who puts out the most power on the bike. It's who gets across the finish line first. So that's why I say I think he's got a ways to go in terms of refining things. And I've heard that he's changed things up over the winter, got some different input. He's very unique in this day and age that he still is somewhat completely self-coached. I mean, he has people with input and guidance, but he mostly calls all the shots himself.
So your schedule for this summer, you mentioned, I think, 14, 15 triathlons you'll be at?
Yeah, I got 14, 15 triathlons, five or six running races, another seven or eight cycling events. I'm doing live streamed online commentary for Athletics Canada for they've started a live streaming service for all their marquee events. The Canadian, it's a big year. It's an Olympic year.
Yes.
So for sports like track and field, it's a big year. So they've launched a live streaming service. So we're doing the first one at the National Indoor Track and Field Championships coming up in 2 weeks' time in Montreal. So I'll do the live stream commentary for that. I think there's a stretch there from early April through until October. Early October, I think I have one weekend off after that stretch. So,
Steve, for somebody who's doing as much as you're doing, does it ever get old? Or is there still? I mean, to me, every time I go to an event, there's a new story. There's something that piques your interest. Something that comes out of every event that is great that we didn't know before we went there. Is that what keeps you in it?
The stories, Bob, and the competition. I just love seeing great competition. I mean, I mean, you can be at some nowhere 5K or triathlon, and you're standing on the side of the course, and you got the microphone in your hand, and there's two guys coming down the final 200 meters, just giving her, and I love that, and that inspires me to do the race call on something like that, just as much as the last finisher coming across the line, you know, like something like the situation where, you know, Matt Long, I was the participant in that, but I've also been on the microphone when that last person comes across the line. I had this happen at an event last year, last finisher, there's like seven or eight of us left there the finish, and she comes across the finish line, and, you know, I gave her a big fanfare when she came across. She came across, she turned to me, hugged me, she said, "This was the best day of my life."
Yeah.
And that kind of made it, you know. I said, wow, like if that's the best day of someone's life, we've just provided that experience for her, that's it. That's fantastic.
Sometimes we forget that there's very few sports in the world. I mean, you and I can't go out to the Masters and go play golf with the best guys. And we can't go to Wimbledon and say, hey, I just want to, you know, knock it around with you, Rafi, for a little bit. But we can sign up and go to a triathlon with a Peter Reed or a Heather Fuhr or a Heather Wirtel or Lionel Sanders and be in the same field at the same time, obviously not going as fast. But to me, that's such a unique part of our sport that everybody, you know, it's a fraternity and sorority of suffering. We all suffer, and you're all challenging the course at the same time.
Very much so. It's been like that from the start, and I remember the times when some of the bigger races made those changes. You probably remember this, when they made the changes to the different start times. There was a big sort of hue and cry about this, suddenly we're not towing the line with them, but we still kind of are. I mean, those races made those decisions for the right reasons, don't get me wrong. But you're right, it's a very open sport. As you well know, the greats of the sport, the champions, be they active or retired, tend to be very down to earth, very open people, very approachable. I've rarely met a person of any level, but in particular the elite sort of professional level athletes in this sport who hasn't been like that, who hasn't been open minded and easygoing. And you know, I've been lucky and fortunate to train with some of them, and like you interview them or, you know, call them across the finish line at big races, small races, and it's extraordinary how humble and easygoing, you know, these people are.
Are you still racing?
No, I race in the sense the club ride on Sunday mornings, and you know the local the sprint to the
yep.
town that's fine is about as close to racing as I get these days. I ride as much as I can, get out a couple times a week, you know, on the bike. We've got one of the I'm lucky where I live up north of the city of Toronto. I live in a town called Aurora. We've got one of the largest cycling clubs in the whole province, and lots of masters, like lots of masters level cyclists. We've got, I think, both the national masters TT champion and the road race champion are members of our club. So hanging in the club ride on a Sunday morning for me, Bob, that's my race.
If I can
stay with the front group, you know, for, you know, 100K on the training ride, then that's the winning race for me.
There's your Ironman medal.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why I remember. I love it. Steve, thanks so much for taking time.
Oh, Bob, this has been great. Real pleasure, as I said at the outset. From afar, you've been a mentor of mine, sort of on the business side, publishing, media, and then the race and events announcing and the emceeing. So it's been a real pleasure. It's been a long time. I've been waiting, you know, to get to do this with you, and it was great to do it with you tonight.
Always a pleasure. So Steve Fleck has been our guest. We are brought to you by Ironman U. EverySite.com, the coolest new technology around. RunCatalina.com. Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. You can check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.